You're listening to The Profile.
Hi, and welcome to The Profile podcast. I'm Andy Peck. For the last 19 years, it's been my joy to investigate how Christians can lead better by talking to a variety of Christian leaders inside and outside the Christian world. So whether you are in a leadership role or simply looking to maximize your influence for God, I hope you find this next conversation helpful. The show is brought to you by Premier Christianity, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Get full online access and the print magazine every month by becoming a subscriber. See special offers available now at premierchristianity.com. Christians are in the change business. They're looking to change themselves as they daily invite God to do his work in their lives of transformation. And they also believe that society itself can benefit from a change in values away from selfishness towards self-sacrifice. But this doesn't mean that Christians in leadership have found needing to change an easy business. Good leadership is always aware of the needs to adjust activity and approach in the light of a challenging environment, whether this be a changing demographic, a change in personnel, or the number of resources that can be used towards a given goal. Well, to help us think through leading a church, charity, or business through change, I'm joined by Nigel Argyle. Nigel is the author of Do, Manage, Lead, and has been on the show many times, and we're grateful that he's given his time once again to help us on this particular issue. So, Nigel, welcome back to the Leadership Show.
Thank you so much. Absolute joy and privilege, as always, to be here. Thank you.
So it may be an obvious question to ask, Nigel. I'm interested in your take on it. Why do we find change so difficult?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, given that we know it's inevitable. Look, here's a little story, quick story. I used to live in Southampton, probably about half a mile from where the Supermarine factory was, where they built Spitfires in the Second World War. And being a bit of an aviation and history buff, I took an interest in that. And it's an extraordinary story because the guys building the planes would be getting on with it. The engineers would come down from the drawing shops, in the top of the building and go, okay, we've got a way of making it better. We've got a new version. It's going to be faster, go higher, different engine. Not surprisingly, the guys building the planes would go, no, go away, leave us alone. We know what we're doing here. Every time you come down and try and change something, we have to stop, we lose production, we need new training, new parts, new tools. Just let us get on with it. And of course, the engineers were going, no, we can improve it. We can make it better. And I think that is a metaphor for probably most of us. Change, it always involves some level of disruption and risk. In theory, because it's going to be better, but we know that's sometimes the case and not always the case. There was a guy called Ronald Heifetz who said, it's a famous quote, what people resist is not change itself, but loss. And I think it's a brilliant observation. What people resist, it's not change itself, it's loss or the risk of loss. I tend to run old cars or relatively old cars. 99 times out of 100, when it finally dies and I upgrade the new car, I go, this is brilliant. Everything about this is better. But actually, that's quite a rare experience. Most of us know that very often change, there is some loss or inefficiency. There is some risk. COVID's a good example. I mean, a lot of people, not everybody, but a lot of people changed to working at home. Big change. I think it took a lot of organizations a while to recognize some of the intangible things that they've lost, that sort of having people in the building, the buzz, the energy, the informal conversation by the water cooler or the photocopier. They hadn't realized they were important until they were gone. And then it's like, okay, we need to sort of recreate that. So familiarity, it's attractive. We know how it works. We know what we're doing. We're confident. It's, in the right sense of the word, fairly easy. You can see why people resist change.
And the irony is, Nigel, of course, is that the the purpose often of the organization, particularly of a church, is that of growth or of assessing the market and doing better in it. And yet what you've described prevents Christians, prevents all people from doing what's needed to adjust. Mm. And so they almost rather die than change. I mean, famously, I think Blockbuster's videos was a famous example of this. And and of course, sadly, we see so many local churches who, you know, for all sorts of reasons, but often their failure to change has meant that they're now used as warehouses for all sorts of products.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a great sort of leadership guru in the States called Simon Sinek. That's spelled S-I-N-E-K. And I don't think he, or he may not be a Christian, but he's got very sort of similar values to us as Christians. One of the things he says relentlessly is you have to start with the why, not what you do, but why you're doing it. And I think this almost... this question comes before you start managing change, and we're going to talk about that in a second, but I think that's the heart of what you've described. I mean, William Temple famously said, the church is the only organization in the world that exists for the benefit of non-members. Now, you know, we love that quote, but it's not 100% true, and often in churches or Christian charities, we're trying to do multiple things. We're trying to kind of look after our members and please them. We're also trying to do something else, which is to do with outreach. We're not quite sure, you know, why we're doing what we're doing or how it's supposed to focus. So there's a sort of loss of focus. Often pushing through change is much easier if we know absolutely clearly what it is we're trying to do and why we're trying to do it. So it's almost that's the first step before you get it onto any process of managing change itself.
Nigel, your book, Do Manage Lead, looks at a number of models from a Christian angle. And you talk there about a change model that helps us understand what's going on. Maybe you could take us through that.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan, as I'm always say this, don't reinvent the wheel. You know, we're not the first people to try and change an organization. If you are trying to change your church, your charity, your business, let's have a look at what's out there. And what I want to do just for a few minutes is talk through probably one of the most well-known globally models of managing change, a guy called John Kotter. That's K-O-T-T-E-R. So you can Google this later if you want to find out a bit more. He basically says there's 8 steps. And what I want to do here actually is just talk fairly quickly through the steps, but I'm going to link them to a Bible story because I think that always kind of helps. Because, you know, we don't want to live in two worlds where we've got our management theories on one hand and we've got our Bible stories on the other, because actually I believe we can put these together. So here we go, 8 steps, and I'll be relatively brief on each one. Step number one, create urgency. You know, your organization needs to know that it has to change for some reason. That can be really hard. I mean, almost by definition, if your business or your charity is in business still, you've survived so far. So, you know, almost why change? You've seen other organizations go, you're still here. Do we really need to change? You may need to be that sort of prophetic lone voice going, yes, we do. I was briefly a trustee of a charity a few years ago, and you could see looking at the finances that giving was just dropping and dropping and dropping relentlessly. It was very strange. I kept saying, guys, look, you know, extend the graft. We're going to go bust in about 3 or 4 years. And people seem to kind of like, no, I think we're doing okay. Or, you know, we've been here before. God will step in. Step two, this is from Kotter, form a coalition. In other words, get a group of people that can see things the way you see, that accept the need for change. We are, I think, prone in Christian culture to sort of loving the idea of the lone hero that rescues their organization. But actually, the reality is the vast majority of people, you know, Wesley, William Booth, it doesn't matter, you know, Jesus with his 12 disciples, actually nearly everybody works in a team. Same with Moses. You look at the story, what's the first thing he does? Actually, he goes and talks to the elders, has to get them on side, I guess probably sort of overcome some resistance from them. But yeah, working as a team. Step three, get a vision for what you want to do. I think it was Stephen Covey who said everything has to be invented twice, once in the imagination of the inventor, and then the sort of physical manifestation of that. Some people are good at this. A lot of us don't get it until we've seen it somewhere. So create vision. In the Moses story, I mean, look, you slaves, God wants to take you to a land flowing with milk and honey. I mean, what an image to slaves. I mean, who haven't got any land, you're going to have your own land. It's going to be fruitful land. I mean, wow, what a dream. Step four, communicate the vision. Again, for us as Christians, actually, often as Christians, we are quite good at this. We're quite good at going to see what is going on. I'm old enough to remember the Toronto blessing, people from all over the world going to see what is this thing that's happening in the Toronto vineyard? Is this for real? What's this about? So, but that's really important. Sometimes I've been on the receiving end of that as a youth worker. I've had people ring me up and say, "We're thinking of doing something. I think it's a bit like what you're doing. Could we come and see what you do?" It's great. So people need to kind of get the vision. You need to spread the vision, communicate the vision. Step five, overcoming obstacles on the way. I mean, in the Moses story, this is the plagues. They are not going to get out easily. There is a whole series of steps on the way. Practically, if you are bringing change in your organization, there are going to be practical problems. Incidentally, this is why you particularly need a team. Some people are brilliant at the big vision, dreaming dream stuff. Other people are way more practical at the day-to-day, overcoming problems, legal stuff, financial stuff, practical stuff. You need a team, but that's the kind of this is the sort of day-to-day working at making change. Step six, celebrating small wins. You will know the story of Moses. The recurring theme is, shall we go back to Egypt? At least we had food there. People need to be encouraged that this is worth it. It's going to be better in the long run. I mean, getting through the Red Sea, huge pivotal moment that, when they come out of that, they're not in the promised land. There's a long, long way to go, but it's an absolutely sort of pivotal step on the way. We need, as humans, we need to sort of celebrate the steps as we see them working. If I've been on sort of mission teams, and the first bit of success is disproportionately important. It's like, yeah, we can do this, we're going to work. God is in this. Step seven, building on the change. Again, Moses in the wilderness, the people are complaining, let's go back to Egypt. God has to bring the manna and the quail. This is about gaining momentum. As you bring change in an organization, there may be resistance, there may be celebration of the first early wins, but just sort of keep pushing on. The last step, and this is sort of super important, Cotter identifies this. Anchoring the change in culture. Every organization has a culture, and culture is very powerful. I like Sheev's definition of culture. It's, quote, "It's how we do things around here." And culture in an organization is often very powerful because it's actually not written down. It kind of hangs invisibly in the air. So, who's really in charge? Is it the CEO? Is it actually run by the CEO's personal assistant? Or, who are the gatekeepers? Who has the information? The person who runs the staff canteen may actually be the best source of information. Well, the way that the diagram of the organization works and the way it actually works may be quite different. Peter Drucker, a great American leadership guru, said famously, "Culture eats strategy for breakfast." It's a great quote. Culture eats strategy for breakfast. If you don't change the way your organization does things, you can bring the practical change, but it won't really work because people kind of just don't actually instinctively b believe in it. So it's the last step, but sort of super, super hard one, but super important one. What does Moses do? He spends the next 40 years getting the Ten Commandments, getting the law. God is working before they get the land. God is working to change the whole way his people think and work and worship. So all of those things go hand in hand. Eight fairly logical steps, but you've got to do all of them. And the final one is super important, anchoring the change in culture.
Cool. And Nigel, that last point kind of leads us into talking about an area that you give a separate chapter to in your book, and that is about adopting change, because we people some people jump at it and others drag their heels. So perhaps say a little bit about the challenge for leaders for those who don't adopt change.
This is fascinating. This is a sort of classic model that gets quoted a lot, and very few people sort of actually look at where it comes from. There's a guy called Everett Rogers. The title of his theory, his tool, is Diffusion of Innovation. And what he basically looks at, this is sort of not how the leaders bring change to an organization. It's how change in any different organization or market or society group, how it's accepted and adopted by the followers, if you like. So he basically says we all fall into different categories. So there's the pioneers. They kind of love change. They're happy to sort of accept the risk and the cost. And then there's the early adopters who are sort of fairly open to this. My father-in-law was an early adopter. He loved his technical stuff. He was the first person I knew to have a Betamax video recorder or a CD player. Always or a computer in his house. I mean, always sort of open to that. Then the next big category is the sort of early majority who are okay, we'll kind of go with this late majority. And then the last group are called the laggards, who are very sort of resistant to change. And there's a sort of bell-shaped curve of distribution. This is one of those classic models. There's no right and wrong place to be. It depends what the issue is. Maybe it's right to change, maybe it isn't. In some situations, you might be a pioneer, in others, you might be a laggard. One of the critical things, though, which is helpful for us as leaders, is basically when you get to probably, it's probably about the first third of people. When you start getting into the early majority adopters, usually at that point, the change has got so much momentum, it will continue. There will be people who haven't yet accepted it, but they kind of accepted this is the way things are going. So it's actually really encouraging to know that you don't have to wait until absolutely everybody is on board with you. This kind of model gives you the idea that there's a sort of momentum point at which the change is going to continue and people broadly will join you.
So Nigel, we've been talking about change in a kind of broad sense. We haven't been specific about what the change is, and as you've hinted, some changes don't matter that much, and others are much more major. And obviously, if we're talking a church context, if it comes to a change in doctrine or views in a particular area, in my lifetime, I'm thinking of changes in the view of the Holy Spirit's work. You mentioned the Toronto Blessing, that the role of women in the church, especially with respect to leadership. And more recently, of course, debates around sexuality and gender. So, do the models discussed apply in these areas, or do you have to nuance them a little bit?
No, it's a brilliant question. I mean, the short answer is they do, but I want to say something to qualify this really carefully, because fundamentally, man, I think that the models cover the idea of managing change well. What I would want to say, though, is managing change well and picking the right strategic direction, those are completely separate issues. I mean, let me give you, well, it's not joking because it's not funny, but I mean, one of my favorite examples is the Titanic. Look at the Titanic. It's in the middle of the ocean. The lights are on, the band's playing, people are eating, drinking champagne, dancing. The management of the ship was absolutely stellar, exemplary. The leadership decision to keep steaming through the night when they had no radar and no binoculars actually turned out to be a catastrophic leadership decision. which cost many, many people their lives. Again, it's a metaphor. I'm sure you have seen this. There are churches and Christian organizations that have decided to go down a certain route on a doctrinal issue, and exactly the ones that you've been talking about, and particularly recently around sort of gender issues and homosexuality. That may or may not work, but that is a completely different issue to whether you actually manage the change well. So you can pick the right direction and manage the change badly, or you can pick the wrong direction but actually manage the change very well. But we have seen, and you will have seen, and we all know organizations that, to use a modern expression, they found themselves on the wrong side of history. They may have managed the change well, but it's still been a bad decision, and they have either had to change direction well, or they've just actually disappeared over time.
Sure. Nigel, your book earths these ideas in scripture. You've hinted at some already. Are there other stories or passages that come to mind as kind of, if you like, biblical backing for change?
No, I love the book of Acts. I think it's a brilliant exploration of this, and obviously many other things as well. But to actually, I mean, the pace of narrative in it is fantastic. And to get that sort of view of the early disciples of Jesus, trying to make sense of what has happened. We have the luxury, having thought about this and reflected on this, and we have Paul's writing, and we can write sort of statements of belief. They didn't have that. They were trying to make sense of it, in real time. And to see them struggling, some of the disputes, the kind of it's to begin with, the assumption is this is a fulfillment of Jewish faith. And the early Christians, I mean, they don't, they think of themselves as Jews. They just believe the Messiah has come. And it's not just the vision Peter has. Over so many different incidents, it's clear, God makes it clear, no, this is not just for the Jews, this is for everybody. And to sort of see that process working out, and the implications of that, and the dispute in Jerusalem, has everybody got to be circumcised? Do we all have to abstain from foods? Can we are we released from this? What does grace mean? I love that because it's a sort of roller coaster ride, seeing the different churches, the organizations trying to make sense, trying to pick the right direction to go in, and then managing the change, trying to keep people on board and not split into sort of subgroups. So Acts is a sort of master class in managing change, I think.
And Nigel, perhaps I should have asked this question a bit earlier, but it's come to mind now. And that is that you hinted at the kind of there are laggards around who don't adopt change. And of course, stereotypically, this is perceived to be the older people who don't like change. And not least, of course, because for many, the church and Christian life is a very very important part of their life. And they, because that's something that's stable, as the world itself is very challenging, So I'm just wondering whether you think this is a temperamental thing rather than an age thing in terms of your capacity to be able to embrace change or not.
I mean, again, great question. And you're right. Stereotypically, we assume older people are resistant to change. I mean, I don't think that's always the case. And sometimes I think younger people can be, in their own strange way, resistant. But they sort of get locked into a certain way of thinking and doing things. And we're sort of used to talking about different generations, aren't we? I think it partially, the heart of this comes back to what we were talking about earlier in the conversation. It's that why do we do what we do? And again, back to the sort of William Temple quote, is churches about us, or is it for somebody else? I think very often I've seen lovely groups of older people embrace change and say something like, this doesn't really work for me. It's not my cup of tea. But you know what? My commitment is to the gospel, to the kingdom of God, and I will put up with that because actually I want to see young people come into church. If we're focused on you're right. If we're focused on the, well, this works for me and I don't want it changed because this is my way of connecting with God and I love it, it's good that it works for you and you helps you connect with God, but it's not okay if you won't let churches do anything else to connect with other people. I mean, I've seen plenty of examples of this kind of thing actually being managed really well, which is wonderful. And lots of churches, I used to attend a big Anglican church in Highfield. We had four services on a Sunday, all quite spectacularly different in style. And you know, in a sense, it's a little bit consumerist, but you picked the service that kind of resonated with your style, your spirituality, the one that sort of helped you connect with God. So these are opportunities for courageous leadership of change. But yes, they can also be real points of friction and difficulty.
Nigel, we obviously would encourage people to buy your book, Do Manage Lead, Essential Bible Tools, sorry, Bible-based tools for leaders. Other books on change that have been valuable to you?
Yeah, as always, Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. I always mention that, but it's good, classic. The other one, to be honest, is John Cotter's book. I'm a great believer in actually reading, you know, what the original people said, rather than buying a book of, you know, what somebody else said he said. So, you know, go back to the guy because it's I think that, you know, they're quite recent additions, certainly the sort of mid late teens of 21st century. So John Cotter, Leading Change. He also wrote a smaller book called Why Transformation Efforts Fail, which is basically a sort of more in-depth version, just in a sense going through his eight steps and looking at the multitude of ways organizations can get it wrong. So yeah, that would be my reading list.
Well, Nigel, this is a feast of material you've given us, and I'm glad that we have a podcast that comes out on a Wednesday so that people can can listen back and make notes as they go if they've not been able to do so. But thank you so much for what you've said and encouraged us towards. And we are in the change business, and I trust that our conversation will help Christians in
Thank you.
leadership wherever they are. Thank you.
Thank you. Been a pleasure being with you. Thank you so much.
It was super to chat with Nigel Argall. If you know you have changes coming up or know you need to make a change, why not follow the steps that Nigel outlined? And in all of us, of course, there can be resistance to what God is doing. He is always good, and our best bet is always to go along with him. He's always kind and patient and has our good in mind. So this is Andy Peck thanking you for your company once again. And looking forward to you joining us again soon. Bye for now.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.